please.
Court is ready to hear argument in 060911, Edwards Aquifer Authority versus Chemical Line Limited.
The court, Mr. Hatch will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Court, this seems to be a day for deadlines. This case is no different. The overlying factual issue is a very simple one. Did Chemical Lime file its application for an initial regular permit for pumping out of the aquifer in time? Even though it was 17 days beyond the date set by the authority. The basic facts are quite simple. The authority set the deadline following the Barshop opinion at December 30th. Chemical Lime was aware of that date, but it missed the deadline by 17 days. The Court of Appeals said that the authority misinterpreted Barshop and set the deadline too early, and therefore Chemical Lime's application was timely. As a matter of fact, it was actually early, about a month early, according to the Court of Appeals. The basis for the Court of Appeals' opinion is an important issue and is the crux of the problem. And that basis is as follows. The Court recognized what my worthy opponent, what we, and what virtually all courts in Texas, including this court, have recognized, and that is that the dissolution of the injunction in Barshop that prevented enforcement of the EAA Act had an immediate effect and therefore constitutionalized both the Act and the authority. But the Court of Appeals said that the trial court, which is true, issued a conjoined declaratory judgment declaring that the act was unconstitutional, that declaratory judgment was not superseded, and therefore it was a legal, quote, impediment, as the Court of Appeals specifically called it, to the effectiveness both of the act and of the authority. And therefore, the authority and the act did not become effective until 8 months later, when the mandate of this court was issued and returned to the court.
Well, let me ask you, you seem to be conjoining the effectiveness of the act and the effectiveness of the authority. And we seem to draw a distinction in Barshop between those two.
Well, as a matter of fact, we think that the court used those terms conjunctively. It is true that the court used the term effectiveness of the act and effectiveness of the authority, but we view the opinion as treating both the same, and I don't see how you really can separate the two, because the authority is created by the act. So if the act is effective, the authority is effective.
If you did not conjoin the two, what would be the basis for distinguishing when the period began to run based on the authority becoming effective?
Well, this court held that when the authority was effective, the legislature intended, by example at least, for there to be a six-month period in which to file the applications under the act.
You can't file an application until you know what the rules are.
That's in a way, I suppose that's true, but for this reason, because the Act says that it must be it must be done on a form specified by the authority. So to the extent that the authority has not specified a form, I suppose that's true. But we read the Act as simply being self-executing insofar as the deadline is concerned.
Well, what if the authority had not put out forms until 10 days before the deadline?
Well, I don't think that would have any effect. It would certainly be disruptive, and that, of course, is not what happened. What happened is that everyone was aware, even though there were actually about 139 days, I think, after the rule became effective for forms to be filled out and turned in, and of the 1,008 applications, only 22 were late. So I think that despite the delay in issuing the rule, there was, has been no demonstrable prejudice effect from that. And please bear in mind, Your Honor, that that would be precisely the same problem that would have been facing the authority if the Barshop decision had never happened. Because under the act as originally done, the authority was going to, the act was going to become effective, and the authority was going to come in existence, and it was going to have to promulgate rules. But the deadline was set by the act itself, so there was going to be some delay. There was never going to be a time when there would be a full 6 month period for with rules in effect and forms on the table.
Were any rules drawn up after the act first passed?
After the act first passed, no. I don't think there were, and I would, my authority is with me, and I can stand to be corrected, but the authority, you have to understand, it, there was a pre-existing agency, and the authority both took all the properties and assumed the position of the previous authority on the interpretation that it was the June 28 Barshop decision that gave them the ability to do that. So, in fact, directors were not even elected until after that time. So prior to then, no, there was not.
So it, nothing had been done to flesh out the application process till July, August.
Not officially, as far as I know. I suppose that it could have been done informally, but I'm not even sure, and certainly the record doesn't reflect this, exactly if the staff was even in place with the ability
to do.
Excuse
me, Mr. Hatch, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there's a lot of noise coming from the back room. Could we have a bailiff or somebody out there help us control that noise? Thank you.
If you'll continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. The interesting dichotomy that has resulted from the decision in this case is that the Edwards Aquifer Act and the authority cannot be enjoined precisely because, as a result of the Barshop decision, they are constitutional. And yet, the judicial system, the citizens of Texas, the judge in this case, and the parties have to proceed as if the act is unconstitutional under the holding of the Court of Appeals. And we say that that is wrong for at least three reasons. First, the language of the opinion is absolutely to the contrary. This court held, we hold today that the deadline was intended to provide 6 months to file a declaration of historical use. And the opinion further says, in accordance with legislative intent, we interpret the act as requiring declarations of historical use to be filed 6 months after the authority becomes effective. The judgment said that the EAA is facially constitutional. The judgment said that the injunction is dissolved, and it is the injunction that prevented the effectiveness. And I would say, first of all, that the declaratory judgment merged into this court's judgment, and any ancillary effect of that certainly was extinguished. We say that our position is correct because of the context of time. Everyone knows that the federal government was about to take over the aquifer, and this court processed the direct appeal from processing the appeal to hearing an argument to issuing an opinion in less time than it took to issue the mandate in this case. We think, therefore, reading the opinion, the urgency in the opinion itself indicates that this court intended the opinion to render both the authority and the act effective immediately. Why is the declaratory judgment not an impediment, as the Court of Appeals has held? First, we think that it falls with the declaration of constitutionality because all ancillary proceedings related to the injunction itself should be merged into and fall. Second, we say that the trial court judgment merged into this court's judgment because certainly one could not enforce the trial court judgment after the declaration of constitutionality. And for that reason, the declaratory judgment should not have prevented the effectiveness of either the act or the authority. We say that the holding confuses the concept for a third reason of enforceability of a judgment of an appellate court and the power to proceed under that judgment. But finally, a point which I think we make in the brief, but I don't think we make it as strongly as we should. We say that the issuance of the mandate cannot be important in this case because the effect of the trial court's judgment in enjoining the act was basically to suspend that act. And since we all know that this court's reversal of the injunction had an immediate effect, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution kicks it into effect at that point. It says that the trial court has no power to suspend a valid act of the legislature. What that means is that once this court declared the act to be constitutional, there was no legal basis and certainly no constitutional basis for the trial court to suspend operation of the act. And therefore, any act doing so is void. So you don't need to get to the question of the mandate. You don't need to get to the question of supersedious.
If the court was right that our opinion did not become effective until the mandate, what happens to everybody else's? I guess, and even Chemical Lime's application was before the mandate
was passed.
So what happens to everybody's applications?
Well, Your Honor, we wish we knew. let me address Chemical Lime's first. In all candor, and I'm not sure this appears in the record, but I don't think I think it's proper to tell the court. I believe the authority was sort of acting like a prematurely filed documents rule that we have in the rules of procedure. And so I think they were accepting premature filings. But the broader question that you raise is one that we are fearful of, but we have no answers to. Let me just try to read off the list of horribles. The election of directors occurred in the gap period between the opinion. We don't know whether that's void or not. Is any action taken during the gap period void? And during that period, we set up our regulatory plan for monitoring the resource in the aquifer, and we also set up rules. Are they all invalid? Regulation of water would be in chaos. At a minimum, do we have to recognize all late filers? Do we have to re-notice again and give everyone the opportunity to refile because of bad notice? And the upshot of all this is going to be, because the cap determines the amount that all of the pumpers can get, if we get more filers, then we have to proportionately, we believe, lower the pumping rights of the existing pumpers. And we believe then that's going to prompt almost a pumper-wide lawsuit against the aquifer.
Why did Chemical Line not file within the six-month period, and does it matter what their rationale is?
Why were they 17 days late?
Yeah.
They were aware. They were aware of the date. They had an employee who was working, trying to compile the 10 years, I believe, of, or it may be longer, of historical pumping data, and he simply was unable to do that. He believes that he made a telephone call to the authority, or maybe two telephone calls, in which he believes that the authority told him to, quote, get it in. And he interpreted get it in to mean get it in anytime you want to. We believe that the more likely thing that happened was that he was told you can get it in by the deadline and you can supplement it. But in any event, it was his interpretation of the phrase get it in that caused him to believe he simply had more time.
Because the authority granted the permit here initially, none of the other water pumpers were affected, right? I mean, what's the status quo right now? Chemical Lime is pumping. They were given the permit. So if they continue with that permit, they
have
not,
as I recall, been given a permit. They've never been given a permit. And I think as a result of this act, they are continuing to pump.
Well, they were given preliminary approval, and then they were sort of revoked. But as it presently stands, no existing pumpers, the Amici, for example, are going to be affected if this application is
timely. I think that is incorrect, Your Honor, because the cap is determined now on the basis of the total, I'm going to use, I think it's called acre feet, of all persons who have permits. And therefore, if chemical lime is put into the mix, then that's going to have to be leveled out and the others are going to have to be reduced. And that would, and that's also true of any other late filers.
No, I understand that, but if others have gotten their permits, are you telling me that is chemical lime the only one that's still pumping but they haven't been approved?
I'm not certain about that.
So you're telling me even though
they're
still...
That's not in the record that I'm aware of.
You're telling me even though they're still pumping, permits weren't granted to other users based on that use?
I think that's correct.
Justice Heck,
do you have a question?
But it's a small amount, right? Their usage is a relatively small amount compared to pumpers in total. I think they say 600 acre feet per year as opposed to 450,000 total.
I think that's correct, yes.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hatchell. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Gilbraith will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The authority is effectively asking this court to give up a pretty important safeguard for ensuring that cases are correctly decided, and that is the ability to change your mind on rehearing. Because if you hold that this court's judgments are immediately effective, then as a practical matter, the court's ability to change its decision on rehearing...
Why would we give that up? In Bar Shop, we said, statute says these 6 months, but we say these 6 months. And then if we changed our mind on rehearing, we'd just say, never mind, those 6 months. So why would... We're the Supreme Court. Why would we give anything up?
Well, you would in future cases, because if you say that in Bar Shop, if... What they want you to rule is that this court's decisions are immediately effective before the mandate issues. So if you go with that holding, which is the holding you would have to reach to sustain their position...
Why wouldn't we want people to obey what we say immediately?
Well, you would... There's a couple of reasons why not, Your Honor. And let me tell you, the first is that they say that, well, the mandate is an inadequate benchmark. But if you tell the public that your decision is the correct benchmark, then I think that's a misleading benchmark. Because think about it, when cases are published in Westlaw, what's the big disclaimer at the top? This decision is not final, it hasn't, and it's not going to be final. Don't rely on it until it's in the official law reports. Well, when does that happen? It's after the motion for rehearing is denied.
But what happens to us if we say this law is unconstitutional and the legislature says, well, the mandate hadn't issued yet, so we're going to keep doing it?
Well, that's the way most courts, when appellate courts have to grapple with this issue, they always say it's the mandate, Your Honor. The original, if you go with their position that the judgment is immediately effective, then the decision essentially becomes a fait accompli. Let's say the court mistakenly upholds the constitutionality of a statute authorizing the termination of parental rights. Well, if the court's judgment is immediately effective, then a whole lot of parental rights could be terminated in the interim before the court grants the motion for rehearing. And there are a host of other unintended consequences that would follow from such a holding. And I want to underscore these next few points because they're not in our brief, but I think they're very important for the court to consider. For example, what about statutes such as Article 7.02F of the Business Corporations Act and Section 61.34C of the Alcoholic Beverage Code, which tie the effective date of an appellate court's decision to its mandate. For example, the Alcoholic Beverage Code provides, if a license is issued on the basis of a district court judgment and that judgment is reversed on appeal, the mandate of the appellate court automatically invalidates the license. And what about supersedious bonds? If this court's judgments are immediately effective, then presumably the prevailing party could go out and collect on the supersedious bond before the court
except
has a chance.
The rules say you can't do that for 30 days.
I don't think so.
so, Your Honor.
Well, and you can't execute for 30 days. You can't do lots of things for 30 days. But, I mean, what do we have? What if we say sue and be sued doesn't waive governmental immunity? So for 8 months or however long it takes us to get the mandate out and the rehearing over in that case while everybody tries to get us to change our minds, trial courts just say, well, we're going to keep doing it. We're just going to keep doing it.
Well,
I mean, we don't send the mandate to anybody. We don't publish it anywhere. How would trial courts ever know when they need to start doing what we tell them to?
The courts...
When we tell them to do it be a good date?
The court, invariably, the courts that have grappled with this issue have said it's when the mandate issues. And another... Think about this.
Which is
John.
Published where?
It's not published, but it's issued by this court.
So everybody needs to start doing it on a date that nobody knows of.
Well, they know when they can check with this court to see when the mandate issues. Attorneys regularly do that. They tell their clients, look, it's not going to become effective until the mandate issues, and then they check with the court. Now, think about this, Your Honor. If the respondents in Barshop had decided to appeal to the United States Supreme Court, what could they have done to prevent this court's decision from taking effect in the meantime? Seek a stay of the court's judgment? Well, I guess if the authority is correct, then yes. But that's not what the rules of appellate procedure call for. The rules specify that under those circumstances, you're supposed to seek a stay of the mandate. That's Rule 18.2, and at the time of Barshop, it was Rule 186B. So I think that rule makes it perfectly clear that it's the mandate that makes this court's decisions effective. And what the authority is asking you to do is just not how appellate courts operate. They do not treat their decisions as immediately effective without taking special steps to make them so. Because as the Eighth Circuit said in the Bailey case that's cited in our brief, an appellate court acts formally and officially only through its mandate. So, for example, in Bush versus Gore, the United States Supreme Court specifically ordered the clerk to issue the mandate immediately. The same is true in United States versus Nixon, the Watergate tapes case. The court ordered the mandate issued immediately. And think about the Elian Gonzalez case. You remember the case of the little boy from Cuba.
But that compounds the problem you started with, though, if you do that. If we go say, okay, well, we have decided we really want people to obey what we say the second we say it.
Correct.
So we'll issue the mandate every time, and then within 6 months or 9 months we'll get motions for a hearing, and then we'll, if we do change our mind, then we undo the mandate, which we told them to do immediately.
You'd have to recall the mandate. But I don't think there are that many cases where this court perceives a need to make its decision immediately effective. Most times the court wants to act deliberately and wait and reconsider its
decision. How many cases are there that you're aware of where trial judges and the legislature ignore our opinions until the mandate issues? I mean, part of the reason we don't have to issue the mandate immediately is because everybody thinks when we say it, it's the law. And if we tell them in this case, no, ignore them. Ignore what we say. Tell the mandate issues. We'll get around to that later. We're not going to tell you when that is. But I'm just trying to figure out how we're going to run this railroad if the date when people think, if what we say is the law doesn't become the law to some date that nobody knows what it is.
Well, it depends. It becomes the law as to when the mandate issue controls as to the parties before the court. Now, there is a difference of opinion among courts about whether it is binding precedent the day the opinion comes out. That's a different issue, and I think that's what you're raising. For our purposes, the mandate is necessary in the case before the court, and that's the point. That's the only point I need to prevail on here. But on the issue of whether the court's decision becomes binding precedent in other cases, courts disagree. I don't know the answer, but I'll tell you what Chief Justice Rehnquist thought when he had to deal with the issue. It's in our supplemental authorities handout. Chief Justice Rehnquist said, look, the decision in Northern Pipeline just isn't effective because we haven't issued our mandate yet. So it wasn't binding precedent in the case before the court. There's also a decision from the Austin Court of Appeals where they say the same thing. A decision by the Court of Criminal Appeals wasn't effective yet because wasn't binding precedent yet because the mandate had not issued. But in the
we've been a little looser about issuing mandates, appellate courts of Texas, than it seems to me the federal system has. Or is that true or not true?
Well, I have checked. I checked, did a spot check on the court's issuance of the mandate in recent years. And in recent years, the court has issued the mandate when it's supposed to be issued or just shortly, a few days thereafter. So I think the court in...
Like there was a time where appellate courts just kind of did it when they got around to it.
There was. That's correct.
An unwelcome burden, and they put it off as long as they could, and maybe Christmas time or something, they turn out a bunch of mandates.
I think many years ago, historically, that did happen. And I would point out on that point, Your Honor, that when Barshop was decided in 96, the mandate was supposed to issue 15 days after the court overruled a motion for rehearing or after the time expired to file a motion for rehearing. In 97, the court shortened that period to 10 days. So I think the court was aware that the mandate is an important instrument, just like in all of these cases I've recited. The Elian Gonzalez case, when the 11th Circuit, it imposed its own injunction. It said, you can't remove this boy from the United States.
Well, that was going to be my question. I mean, should we draw a difference in this case between the declaratory judgment and the dissolution of the injunction?
Because no.
The fact that we immediately dissolve the injunction, doesn't that sort of operate as a mandate?
No, Your Honor. I think that I would disagree to a certain extent with the Court of Appeals on that issue, and that is I don't think that the injunction was immediately dissolved. They've relied on a number of older cases that were decided before the rules were amended on this issue. The key here is when this court's decision became effective, and I don't agree with this notion that the injunction was immediately dissolved, but that the declaratory judgment remained in place. Nothing happened until the court issued its mandate. It's as between these parties. Court's decision.
What about applications filed like yours pre-mandate?
Those applications are effective. They were prematurely filed. They become deemed effective on the date that the rules take effect. And there's an
interesting... Why is that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why?
The reason is...
But if I file my application 1899, the authority hadn't even been dreamed of then. Why would that be effective?
The reason is, Your Honor, in Section 1.41 of the original Edwards Aquifer Authority Act, they've got in their appendix a more recent addition that's not relevant on this question, so you have to go back and look at the copy in the record. But in Section 1.41, the legislature provided that rules passed by the Edwards Aquifer Underground Water District would be effective rules for the authority. And so they would be, just because the authority changed, the prior rules would become effective.
The rules of the predecessor entity? The rules of the predecessor
agency? That was the predecessor agency. And so for that reason, this parade of horribles that you heard earlier is a non-starter. For that reason, and also because, as we pointed out in our brief, in 2007, the legislature amended the act.
But the only reason there was a six-month period deadline is because these folks said it was, which you're saying these folks didn't exist at the time. So really, nobody has ever said, and at a time when this group outfit was effective, nobody's ever said what the deadline is, and people could file today, or at least before our mandate issues in this case.
No, Your Honor. I don't think it was the authority that said it was a six-month deadline. It was this court in Barshop. So that's
and
why.
And your guy knew about it.
He knew about it, but he called the authority and he spoke with Gail Kipp and he said, look, I'm having trouble getting this 20 years worth of data. This plant's been around since 1907. I'm having trouble getting this 20 years worth of data. What should I do?
Never mind. Don't worry about it. That's just the Supreme Court.
No, well,
and their mandate hadn't issued anyway.
Well, that was before the Supreme Court's decision. I mean, that was not the issue then. What the issue was is he calls and he says, I'm having trouble getting this. And she says, well, when you get that data, just get it in. Now, if she had just told us that the authority had an unwritten rule that they would accept applications with incomplete data, then we would have filed their application and got the data later.
Do you have an argument for a substantial complying with all the rules that have been presented to you?
Yes, Your Honor. I think what the court should consider on the substantial compliance point is that there was, in this case, you know, what they rely on is this United States Supreme Court case, the Locke case. So, well, you can't have substantial compliance with a deadline. Well, this court and other state courts don't necessarily agree with that viewpoint. And in the Helena Chemical Company case versus Wilkins, the court said that you could substantially comply with the deadline. But also, I would like for the court to consider on that point that here you have a situation of official mistake that is added into the mix, so that under those circumstances, we suggest that you can certainly have substantial compliance. Think about the Baker versus Goldsmith, the old Bill of Review cases like that, where you consider official mistake. And here you do have official mistake because you have the agency.
We've said that government agencies can't be stopped by somebody who answers the phone and says, oh, pay no attention to our deadlines.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so that's all you're saying here, though.
I don't think so, Your Honor. No, I think we have a different argument, a substantial compliance argument that's distinguishable from that situation.
But harking back to our two previous cases this morning, everybody else is going to be prejudiced. When the water level's low and in drought years and everybody's going to get cut back, the more people we add on, like your client, the less everybody else gets.
I don't believe there will be any additional applications approved because of this.
If we add your guy, and leaving aside the question of whether, since we're declaring none of this, all of this happened during a time when the agency didn't exist because the mandate hadn't issued. If we add your guy, then in times of dry weather, everybody else is going to get a little less. So there's no question there's going to be prejudice from this late filing.
I disagree, Your Honor, because we have been drawing water since 1907. We have continued to draw water, even though they want to deny our permit. We have been continuing to draw water. They gave us an initial regular permit, a proposed permit. We've been continuing to draw it. They have got to have factored that in. They've got no evidence to say we haven't factored that in.
How does the 600 acre feet, whatever your client is using, how does that total amount work in a total scheme of the water that's been drawn? Sounds pretty minimal to me.
It's very minimal. There's 572,000 acre feet that the legislature approved in the last session now, and they approved that based on all pending applications. They said that's the amount that is needed to cover all pending applications. Our application has been pending.
So if you have substantial compliance, company's been around since 1907 doing the same thing it's doing then, it's doing now. You have minimal water draw. Are those factors for us to consider, or do we just look to when the mandate may or may not have issued?
Well, I think you should consider those factors, Your Honor. I think there are a number of factors to be considered in this case beyond just, I mean, if you rule in their favor, the mandate issue is going to be a serious problem because of all of the unintended, unforeseeable consequences that it will cause. For example, the statutes I pointed out, but also these factors like our substantial compliance, the court's use of the language in the, when it adopted the or embraced the holding in the Stevenson case and said the rules aren't going to be, or the 6 months doesn't begin to run until the authority becomes effective. And here, how can you say that the authority was effective for purposes of accepting applications before they even knew what the applications looked like? I mean, they want to start the deadline 2 months before they even thought about what the application forms would look like. And even the state in its amicus brief says the legislature intended that applicants have 6 months to file the necessary paperwork. Now, how would you have 6 months if the authority hasn't even told you what the paperwork is supposed to look like? And on the other hand, they're telling you got to fill out one of their forms.
Can I ask you to clarify just one point? A moment ago, in answers to Justice Brister, did you say that the court set the six-month deadline or the authority?
It was the court.
Well, in the Court of Appeals opinion, and maybe we'll just need to look at the record on this, it says that in lieu of the then-expired 1994 statutory deadline, the authority, relying on an interpretation of Barshop, set by rule a deadline of December 30th, 1996, 6 months after Barshop.
Oh, correct, Your Honor. Yes, it was.
Maybe I'm confusing.
The authority is the one that set the specific deadline. It was this court that said we interpret the legislature as intending that parties have 6 months to file their application. So that's what I intended to say. So the authority, yes, did choose the specific deadline.
You refer to the state's brief, and they have a different position about the effect of the notice of appeal on the trial court's judgment. Respond briefly to that.
Their Their argument is wrong, Your Honor, because this court has said that the state's notice of appeal will act as a supersedious unless a contrary intention is expressed. And here, a contrary intention was very clearly expressed.
By the trial court, you mean?
By the state. When the state expresses a contrary intention, then there's no supersedious. And they did that in about three different ways. I mean, first, when they filed their notice of appeals, they said we're not bound by the old cost bond requirement back then, but they didn't say anything about the supersedious bond requirement. And then when the trial court denied them supersedious, they said, oh, well, we'll just let it go. They didn't challenge that. They had a right to do so. And then when they got in this court, in order to prevent the court from holding the deadline holding the statute unconstitutional because the deadline had passed, they said, well, the act hasn't been in effect all this time, which, of course, if the judgment or if their notice of appeal had superseded the trial court's judgment, then yes, it would have been in effect. So when in this court they said, no, the act hasn't been in effect, so they essentially conceded that their notice of appeal did not supersede the trial court's judgment.
Do you know whether anything was done by the authority or staff or otherwise during that period of time?
During which period?
Until this court held that the act was constitutional.
No, I do not, Your Honor. I do not.
There was a voting problem at some point, so I guess nothing was done then.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counselor.
It please the court and Justice O'Neill, I have the answer to your question. It's outside the record, but I do think that it's mentioned in the respondent's brief. There has never been a regular permit issued to Chemical Lime by the Board of Directors. And they're the only ones that can issue a permit. But they are pumping today under an interim permit that's been granted by agreement. We had understood that that was not to be part of the record, but since it's been mentioned.
So everyone else's rights has taken into account that interim permit they were allocated.
No, that's not correct.
Why would you issue an interim permit?
Well, I think that, again, this is outside the record. They would issue the permit, I suppose, to keep the status quo during the pendency of the litigation. So,
how do you deal with Trap Rule 18.6?
Oh, that's my favorite subject.
And the illogical result.
I find that I'm oftentimes the only person, along with Justice Hecht, who has lived through the history of these rules. Well, first of all, let me say that at least in olden times, there were many, many considerations in interlocutory appeals that would justify the old 385 rule and to the 18.1 rule as we now have. As sometimes happens, I think the rule is not really written to reflect what was going on. The colorful bit of judicial history behind the rule is that there was
without going into the history of the rule, what's the logical reason for making an accelerated appeal await the mandate for effectiveness, but an irregular appeal?
Well, the answer is because Judge D. Brown Walker in Dallas was notorious for, since he was in the courthouse, finding out the opinions of the Court of Appeals in interlocutory appeals and doing something within the case before the mandate came down. And Justice Clarence Cotard carried this rule amendment to the court.
I'm not asking how it happened. I'm asking what's the logical basis, regardless of what may have happened in one court.
Logical basis is to give the courts of appeals the immediate authority to issue its mandate with its opinion in interlocutory appeals so that trial courts will obey the judgment of the court. And that brings me, I think.
But why should it be different on regular appeal?
Well, it's different because in regular appeals, the mandate occupies three different roles. It occupies a role of simply providing notice to the trial court that a judgment has been rendered.
As it does in the other, in an interlocutory appeal.
It occupies the role of reinvesting the trial court with power to enforce the judgment. And it finally occupies a role simply to carry the judgment into effect. But in this particular case, I mean, allow the trial court to do what needs to be done to implement that. But in this particular case, where the court has already stated that the injunction is dissolved and the action is constitutional, the mandate occupies nothing more than a formal role. It does not, it does provide notice, but it does not require any enforcement. And there was no need in this case, therefore, to prevent the trial court from interfering with the appellate court jurisdiction.
So, to take some words from the response brief, you'd say that in a regular appeal, the mandate is nothing more than a nagging and duplicative reminder.
That's not really necessarily true. It depends on the circumstances of each case. And I think if you look at the kinds of cases in which the court has said that there is immediate effect to the judgment, you will see that there are many kinds of cases involving custody orders, contempt, conservatorship, injunctions, and receiverships that need to have an immediate effect. But on the other hand, there are many kinds of cases which are reversed and remanded where the rights of the parties must be adjusted. And it's that adjustment, the re-empowering of the trial court to adjust those rights, as to where the mandate has its most, probably its highest calling. In this case, it had no calling at all because everything had been done.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The clause is submitted. That concludes the oral arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.